Hey, it's all one conversation, one big conversation.
You know it is in the end, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like all these multiple-celled organisms all questing to become one cell again, back to the amoeba.
Yeah, I felt about this conference, too, that I kept adding layers and layers of complexity, and once you get enough, it could get simple again.
Yeah, that's true. That's what happens, they say, that chaos builds up to order, the next
Martin
computer.
Martin actually formulated that formally in math at the University of Princeton, of the emergence of syntax in human language.
Uh-huh.
You get to a certain point when all you're using is words, you don't have sentences. And then you got one word for every situation. But, you know, your culture is getting more and more complex, so eventually you can't have a new word for every situation. You need syntax in order to make sense of things, or you'll go crazy.
Yeah, in terms of context. Yeah. Well, once we had enough people, enough speakers, then we got to the size where then we could hire people to help us with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it became simpler.
And here we are.
Yes.
Just to start, like, thank you, Rick Doblin, for this interview with Reality Sandwich. We're here at the MAPS Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies 2010 Psychedelic Science Conference. Now, you were formed in 1986. So it's
1986.
Yep. Yeah. It's been a while, but it really seems like this psychedelic renaissance is really all the groundwork and the seeding that MAPS has done, and the support of individual researchers and scientists seems to have really reached a very public peak recently. How do you feel about the work MAPS has been doing in the last 20 plus years?
Well, I feel like we could have done it in 4 years if we didn't have to go through this incredible resistance, but we did. So I feel like tremendous. I mean, that we're at the end of the beginning of the psychedelic renaissance, and we're there in such a solid place where there are studies all over the world. There's pilot studies that are starting to come out with promising data. None of them have been accepted for publication, but they're under review. Our MDMA PTSD study from the United States, Charlie Grobe's psilocybin cancer anxiety study, they're both nearing final stages of peer review process. So I feel like things are going to continue to build and gather momentum and get even stronger.
You were saying, obviously, you had a lot of blockage from government sources, and there's been maybe a top level cultural embargo or something against this type of research for the last 30-40 years, but MAPS has been the spearhead organization has been chipping away at that, but you've obviously encountered a lot of blockages. How have you been dealing with that on an ongoing basis?
By being incredibly patient, because a lot of them you just can't get over. You have to go around, and it takes a long time sometimes. Like, for example, when MDMA was first criminalized in 1985, it took us 7 years before we could get permission for the first study where we administered MDMA to humans. And in between 85 and 92, we had about 5 different studies that were all rejected. So the key part has been redefining success. So if success were doing these studies, getting these drugs as prescription medicines, I would have been demoralized and depressed. But I was able to recognize that it's such a big picture that it's no one of us can really influence completely how it happens. And so I recognize that if I could just work hard at it and try to be happy because of that and satisfied, then I could deal with all these decades of making no progress.
Yeah.
Or making little progress. So
why do you think there is progress now, though? Apart from all the government regulations, there seems to be a cultural shift happening in Western culture where they're embracing the idea of psychedelic medicines and of psychedelics themselves. It's almost like the culture is ready to integrate where it wasn't and was threatened by it 50 years ago.
Yeah. I think, one of the ways to say is that psychedelics bring us in touch with the death-rebirth process, just raw human emotion, and that in the 50s and 60s, when psychedelics were emerging, people didn't talk about death. My aunt died when she was 21 years old of cancer. This was in 1957, and my grandparents never even told her she had cancer, because that was the idea, you can't even talk about it.
Wow.
The women who were giving birth, a lot of them were tranquilized, and it was highly medicalized thing. So over the last 40 years, the hospice movement, the first one was in 1974, and by 2004, there was 3,500. So we've taken death out of the shadows and gotten more comfortable with it. We've taken birth out of this heavily medicalized system, and then we've also integrated yoga, integrated meditation into our culture. And I think that there's been one of the benefits, you could say, of global warming or is that people are more and more realizing that there are planetary systems, and they're looking at things from beyond their national borders. So there's this growing global spirituality of identification, and that's sort of causing the fundamentalists in the different areas to hold on even tighter. So one view of the world might be that there's, you know, increasing fundamentalism. But if you look at the Catholic Church, the erosion of their credibility and authority because of the sexual abuse scandals, even the very, you know, martyrdom-oriented religions, then I think there's more of a need right now. There's more of a sense of desperation in a way. And there's also this reservoir of people who were young in the 60s who for the most part have abandoned psychedelics, abandoned drugs while they had their careers and their families, and they've had to do drug testing. Now they're coming back.
Do you think they're coming back in a recognizable way, the elders? Because that's what we need, that bridge between the generations.
I do think so. Particularly as they are coming around to facing death and pain and illness. I think it's in a way natural that at the beginning of your life, for rites of passage, to figure out where your direction is, and then at the end of life, for the same kind of thing, to figure out what you did do, and you know how you are going to manage this more difficult process of letting go and dying.
MAPS has the very strategic objective of getting psychedelics and marijuana legalized for medicinal usages. At the same time, there's other cultural vectors happening, like the massive ayahuasca movement worldwide, which I guess has a more, it's a hands-on medicinal sort of component, but it's almost a religious or spiritual adjunct as well. How do you see those two streams of the outside community from MAPS doing the spiritual approach to psychedelics and entheogens, paralleling the medicinal stream?
Well, there's three tracks here at this conference. You know, one is the science, and there's an entire track that's ayahuasca. That just sort of emerged from this community. I think that there's political struggles related to religious freedom and human rights that make the argument that drugs should be legally available. And I think that's a bigger argument. It's really true, but it's harder to, you know, persuade people of the big picture initially. So the medicine and the research with the medical applications is the opening door. The society is more willing. We have the mechanisms through the FDA. We have the incredible need for treating PTSD from soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think for us still that our resources are focused on medical applications and then expanding legal context for use. I think the religious dimension and the religious freedom cases, the work that Ron Griffiths is doing with psilocybin and mystical experiences, that's extremely important. And we touch on that with working with people at the end of life, because that's often where a spiritual experience can help transform their perception of pain, their perception of anxiety, and also get them to work with their loved ones to say the things that need to be said and enrich the life that they still have. So the spirituality comes in more at the end of life than with MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think there are other groups that are really working a lot on the religious freedom. So Roy Haber is the attorney for the Santo Daime. He's here. He won a major religious freedom case. There's been the UDV that went to the Supreme Court, the Native American churches, legal to use peyote. So they can run concurrently, but I think in any movement you need some people that are doing this and some people are doing that. And
sure.
The part where I see our maximum leverage is the medical application.
And what do you think, like the whole thing with the 60s and just with LSD seemed to become a threat to the establishment because it was unregulated, it was used, I guess, unwisely by the masses, en masse, in the face of the public, without a controlled set and setting in a way. But do you think that there's, is there any danger with the psychedelics coming back into the medical fold that will pigeonhole them into that stream, but there's also going to be street use, and then there's all these other drugs being used on the street, but there's a thirst for a tribal guidance in a way of how to use substances properly?
Yeah, well, I think when we look back at the 60s, I think it's a little bit too easy to say that the mass misuse is what led to the crackdown. And the follow-up study that I did to the Good Friday experiment that was done by Timothy Leary, who was the faculty sponsor in 1962, and it was about helping people who were religiously inclined to see if psilocybin would help them have mystical experiences.
The Walter Panky Good Friday experience?
Yeah. And I did a follow-up study 25 years later, and I talked to the various people in the middle 80s. And what I learned from them is that they remembered their mystical experiences from psilocybin before. They still considered them valid. And they said that there was a link between the unitive sense of connection, a little bit of their loss of fear of death, a little bit of empowerment that led them to do work in social justice movements. Some talked about the civil rights movement, others talked about the environmental movement, some talked about the anti-war movement, the women's rights movement. So I think it's when psychedelics went right was the main reason that there was the crackdown. And the reason that psychedelics went wrong was kind of the excuse. We've got to protect these people who were having these bad experiences, killing themselves, you know, going to hospital emergency rooms. And there was a lot of that. And at the same time, though, I think it was this association of people who were inspired by the sense of connection and the implications of that to challenge the status quo. And at the time, we had a very rigid political system with Nixon at the top. We had a culture that was just emerging from this highly repressed time. And also we had people who were part of this who had the belief that there is such a thing as a counterculture, that there is a way, that you can go away and create, you know, a private utopia somewhere else. And so I think the main difference in the last 40 years, 45 years, is that now we all realize there is no away. There is no place to run. How do you hide from global warming? How do you hide from nuclear annihilation? How do you, you know, so I think that the direction of the rebels is more like, can we be scouts for a culture that appreciate us, you know, going into the new ground, rather than being seen as threats to the culture because we're undermining these beliefs. And I think now we've got a big enough reservoir of people who have, who are the culture, who were very involved in the 60s with the psychedelic community, who have found ways to live their lives where you can't tell, you know, them from anybody else. And so we are, this community, this perception is more integrated. And the other thing that has been incredibly encouraging, I thought for a long time that the interest in psychedelics might be just like a blip in this baby boomer group from the 60s, and that it failed and we were crushed, and then these younger generations would have something else. And that they would look at us as, like, you know, these silly old babies are no longer relevant, and look, we have iPhones and we have all this technology. And so what has happened that I've been able to see over the last 15, maybe the last 5, 10 years, is really that the younger generations, in part through the rave movement, in other ways, that they are seeing the value here. It's not like this generation that is really isolated from the ones that went before and are coming after. So I feel much more relaxed now, and that's a big part of this idea of being patient, that we can't do it all in our own lifetimes, but that if it will be something that is shared down the generations.
What's your ultimate vision then for a psychedelic global culture?
Well, I would like us to be taken for granted. You know, it's like when you look, most everybody here, you know, all the way, if you, like, I bet that very few of the women here think much about the suffragettes that got them the right to vote. I mean, women have only been voting for 80 years or so. And, you know, it's like you grow up in a situation where you can vote, you just say, no, that's the way it's always been. So I think that this global spirituality, the United Religions, as a complement to the United Nations, and then also the recognition that people should have the human right to form their own religion. They don't need to be part of an organized group. That's part of the problem of these religious freedom cases, is that it's always as part of this group. And I think that deep spirituality begins with the individual, and you can find support with a group, but you have to be free to explore on your own. So ideally there would be networks of psychedelic clinics with specially trained therapists and physicians, and at the same time these clinics could be like rites of passage centers, like a driver's license test, where you go to a clinic, just as when you want to learn how to drive, you have to demonstrate you can drive to somebody who's going to take you out in a car, and it costs the society a little bit of money to have this kind of test. But you know, so I think that if you're a young person, you go to these clinics, you have an experience under supervision, you don't have a panic reaction, then you get your little card and you can go do it on your own. and so that there would be more opportunities for people to have these individual experiences and also more social context and more support if people wanted it that way.
Well, let's hope, hey? Let's pray that it is so. Thank you for your time, Rick. And congratulations on MAPS achieving such a dynamic result for bringing together the psychedelic culture here in 2010.
Well, you may, I don't know if you know this, but the first conference in Basel in 2006, the World Psychedelic Forum, when Albert Hofmann was 100 years old, they lost about $100,000 on that conference.
Wow. No.
They did, even though there was like thousands of people there.
It was booked out. Yeah.
It was totally booked out, but they lost about $100,000. They kept adding things and adding things.
Yeah.
So I can say, unless something incredibly unexpected is going to happen, is that we will make money on this conference.
That's good.
Our goal is to break even.
And how can people donate to MAPS to help support the psychedelic cause?
They can donate by going to our website, maps.org, or they can donate. Right now, because we're sort of focusing on work with end of life, we're asking people to leave money to MAPS in their will, to put MAPS in their, as a bequest. Because it's clear more and more that this is a multi-generational strategy. MAPS has been around for 24 years now. So people could consider that. People also are free, if they want to donate for a restricted project and say, I want my money only to go to this. I only want MDMA for veterans. Mm. Or I only want, LSD for people at end of life. Mm. So we permit targeted restricted donations. More and more we're starting to develop alliances with people, with nonprofit organizations in other countries. Mm. There's people from 20 different countries here at the conference. We're starting a MAPS Canada. I was approached about a MAPS Australia.
Okay. Yeah.
We have an organization in Switzerland. So that donors in their different countries, because we are international in our research, if they want to make a donation to MAPS, they could inquire first, do we have any associated organizations in their own countries? And then they can get tax deductions for that.
Great. The network spreads.
Yes, it does.
Excellent. All right. Thank you very much for your time, Ray. Appreciate it.
Great.
Excellent. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you again.
Yeah.
It's always good to meet you, Rick, and hang out.
Yeah.
You know? It's Bernie Mann, he's there with his shirt off, and we're hanging out. You know, now he's in his suit, and we're hanging out.
Well, I feel more at home with Bernie Mann, but I'm getting used to this.
Yeah.
I can do it. I wasn't really sure.
Cool.
Because I was worried I would lose myself.
Just the different masks of God that we all wear.
You can carry a vial of quiet dust around.
Snip it like snuff, when people are listening to it.
Yeah.
Cheers, mate.
And we collected a great deal of data, both neurobiologic and psychological data.
Charles, what was the short version of maybe some of the studies of the broad ayahuasca does in a Western, medicine sense or neurological sense?
Right. Well, we part of our study, and this was along with Jace Calloway from the University of Kuopio in Finland, we collected blood from both the ayahuasca subjects and the non-ayahuasca exposed controls. Jace took the bloods back to Finland, and he assayed for a platelet serotonin transporter and found that the two groups were distinctly different, and in fact there was a higher density of the serotonin transporter on the platelets of the ayahuasca subjects as opposed to the non-ayahuasca exposed controls.
Is that a long-term thing, or is that something that you have to keep replenishing with regular ayahuasca use? Well,
this seems to be a relatively long-term phenomenon because subjects were instructed to be abstinent from ayahuasca for 30 days prior to their participation in the study.
Mm. Okay. And now, what's your thoughts on the booming ayahuasca culture in the West? And if it's used in traditional tribal indigenous settings, it's almost a religious sacrament as well as a medicine.
Right.
And at the moment, it seems to be spreading throughout the West as almost a fad religion or a new age type of adjunct to spirituality.
Right.
But there's also deep medicinal use of it there too. What do you see happening in the culture?
Well, there's certainly growing interest. When we first started our ayahuasca project in the early 90s, and I would tell people what I was doing, they never heard of ayahuasca. They would say ayahuasca. But now the word is out. Far more people are aware, and many people have traveled to the Amazon. There's also ayahuasca, which has been transported up to the United States, and it's a growing phenomenon. I think it's essential that people understand that this is a sacred medicine. I think it's essential that we learn from the wisdom accrued over millennia by indigenous shamanic practitioners. I think that's essential to optimize both safety and positive outcome.
Well, to take it, you know, from going from an indigenous plant medicine that's been used for thousands of years to something very modern like MDMA, you've been involved with studies with MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder?
I conducted the first FDA-approved study. Mm-hmm. We studied the effects of MDMA in normal volunteers.
Okay.
We did not do a clinical treatment study. The PTSD study was done by Michael Bithoffer in South Carolina.
Sure.
Yeah, but these are very different compounds, both pharmacologically and you know, as ayahuasca has a very, very long, extensive history, you know, MDMA is really an invention of the, you know, just of the last, although it was synthesized at the beginning of the 20th century, it only was examined in the last 20 years. So it's very different kind of compound, different level of use. MDMA has been utilized widely in a recreational context. I could never imagine ayahuasca to be used recreationally. I think there would be...
What about something that's a middle ground here? You've also done work with psilocybin on cancer patients, so that's traditionally used by Mazatec Americans.
Right. And again, I think it's essential to learn from what the indigenous peoples have learned, because they've worked with these compounds over vast periods of time. But our study with psilocybin was to examine whether a psilocybin treatment model might alleviate some of the anxiety that patients with advanced stage cancer have.
And how was your findings?
Well, we had good results. First of all, we established a feasibility. We could get the approvals, we could get the funding, and we could actually accomplish what we set out to do. We found that we felt we established good safety parameters. No one had a bad experience psychologically. No one had any adverse medical effects. And in terms of outcome, we found that indeed these people did appear to have some amelioration of anxiety, even months after the experience, as well as improved mood and overall improved quality of life.
I know that there was a recent follow-up study to the Walter Pankey, Divinity studies with psilocybin in the 60s. Is there something you think psilocybin invokes a religious response as well as a medicinal or a physiological
response?
Well,
absolutely. I mean, these are sacred medicines, and they allow us to, really explore the great existential issues, and I think they have to be taken with the utmost seriousness. They're not trivial compounds, and they should not be trifled with.
Do you see a time when then, you know, in the Western sense, we'll legally be able to use them when we're not terminally ill or we're not having something that's a disease, but can we be well but still disconnected from a spirituality, and can they help us back to that track?
Well, I think they could reconnect people to a spiritual path. I think even in individuals who might identify themselves as being without spirituality, a powerful psilocybin experience that might have the potential under optimal conditions to induce a mystical level experience can clearly have a profound impact on altering someone's perspective towards even the very existence of a spiritual realm.
Mm. And just briefly, I mean, do you have optimism for the future of psychedelics?
Oh, I do. I think this is I think these are medicines with profound potential for a variety of reasons. They were, in a sense, put on ice after the turmoil of the 60s for several decades. But now we're getting to the point where it's once again feasible to get approval. And I think, most importantly, our group and the group at Hopkins and the group at NYU are establishing that it's possible to establish safety parameters. You know, that's an essential first step. And now we're exploring whether we can facilitate a therapeutic outcome. And I'm very optimistic about the future, although I will, you know, qualify that by, you know, not for the immediate future, but for the, you know, the distant future. I think it's inevitable that this model will gain in stature and in acceptance.
So when you say this model, you mean you see the future, like maybe not short-term, but medium-term future will be as a medicinal model where it's dispensaries like medical marijuana or something like that?
There's a model that Albert Hofmann talks about, which was the model of a retreat center where trained and credentialed facilitators will initiate people into this realm and do so in as optimally safe a manner as possible, and then help them with the integration of their experience afterwards. That that's a model that I could see happening. I don't see that it's going to be available with a simple prescription.
Yep. Excellent. All right, thank you very much for your time, Charles.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Good luck and
thanks.
Congratulations again.
Thank you.
Okay.
MAPS sponsoring studies on the use of MDMA, you know, with PTSD. Mm. PTSD is an unbelievable, horrendous problem. Mm. I was just talking to Rick Doblin. There's 250,000 people suffering from PTSD from Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, and more dozens more every month. Mm. And there's no way of treating them. It costs, Rick, I just talked to Rick about this, it costs something like $5 billion. Pentagon, the general funding to take care of these people, disability people, for the rest of their life. There's no way to treat them. Well, you're on drugs, disability for the rest of your life. Now, MDMA is the most promising treatment for PTSD that's ever been discovered, bar none.
I think
the evidence is very, very strong. But well, how many subjects have there been done? Three, four, half a dozen.
You know? I mean, psychedelic medicine obviously has a very effective usage that could help people, but do you think it could actually be used almost as a soma for the masses or as something to keep them in the paradigm?
I doubt it very much. I doubt very much the devil.
You know, they treat the post-traumatic stress disorder, but they don't cause the root cause of war or the culture which goes to war.
No, yeah, right. Well, but, you know, even if you just found some way to heal people, these terribly wounded people, you know, that in itself would be a peacemaking gesture. You know, I don't think it's ever going to be something that be available. And Henry didn't think so either. I mean, he testified at one point in Congress saying drugs need to be regulated. Of course, the whole debate about legalization and criminalization is pointless. You know, it's not a dualistic either or. You have to do one or the other. You know, they have to be regulated. And I, for one, for example, think alcohol should be regulated more. There should be involved. It really needs to say you should, you know, just like you have to get a pilot's license or an automobile license to be able to get into a car or a plane, you have to be educated, you have to be trained and guided, and, you know, before you give your license to buy your own plane and go fly around.
Same
thing. And should be the same thing. And I think the same thing should apply to alcohol. Before, I think there should be more regulation because alcohol is far too dangerous to just hand out to people. You know, we should have a, just like you do for a driver's license, you have to have an educational program. What are the effects of alcohol on the brain? What are the chances of developing alcoholism? What are the statistics on alcoholism and how you treat it? This is a major public health disaster. You know, so
what do you think in general then is the near-term future of psychedelics?
And I think the same applies to cannabis. I think cannabis is the one modality that has a chance of becoming regulated as even beyond the medical framework. You know, in California, it's on an initiative process there. But obviously it has to be regulated, and obviously the law's already on the books. You don't need to pass more law. The law's already on the books. You don't drive. You don't give it to teenagers and underage people, you know. And you don't protect people from harm. That's the whole thing. The whole drug thing needs to be moved out of law enforcement. The use of drugs needs to be out of law enforcement into public health. And of course, yes, people have addictions and, you know, all that kind of thing, and they need to be treated, not jailed.
Yeah.
You know, you get these, 2.5 million people who are victimless crimes. What's that to do, you know, with the economy? And I think the economic argument is very strong. You know, California has got a $22 billion deficit, and if they regulated and taxed the cannabis production, that'd be $5 billion, besides a chunk of the deficit. And I think there's a good chance that something like that could happen. 1935, you know, the alcohol prohibition was repealed, right? In the midst of the Depression. People finally woke up, why should we let the gangsters and alcohol get all the money from this? And we could tax it, and we could, you know.
So, Rob, do you feel optimistic about the near-term future of psychedelics?
I really don't know anymore what's optimistic or pessimistic. You know, it's too. I mean, there's some good things and there's some positive things. I think in the area of treatments, the two most positive applications that are being discussed here and that are, you know, have been widely demonstrated and Europe as well, is the use of psychedelics in the treatment of addictions. Because their consciousness expanding as a treatment to consciousness contraction, and the use of psychedelics as a aid to helping people prepare for dying. You know, and there are some studies like that. They reduce death, anxiety around terminal psilocybin with MDMA. And there's so much misunderstanding. That's all part of the worldview. And misunderstanding and misconceptions about death and fear. And you know, you can't very easily change people's worldview, but you can certainly make things easier for them. And the studies are very, very clear. People take, you know, with no prior experience, have got a terminal diagnosis, they take psilocybin or MDMA, and they have a really good chance, you know, going into that final transition with a peaceful attitude, which is a blessing, absolutely, that could come out of us.
All right. Thank you very much for your time, Ralph. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Good luck with your future.
Yes.
What was the book again?
Here's the book.
Right.
The psychedelic
conversations about Leary, Harvard, and experiments in the book in the 60s.
Yeah, that's great. I think it's really important that people... I think one good thing about psychedelic culture, people are usually interested in the history of it. You know, it's...
Yeah. Right, sure. And it's, because it's an underground culture, so the history of it is kind of hidden.
Yeah.
But it's also not hidden.
It's there if people want to seek it out.
Yeah, it's like classic.
Yeah.
You know, I've written, edited two books on experiences with ayahuasca and psilocybin mushroom. Then I just let people describe the experiences in their own words, as well as giving the signs and so forth. But you don't identify the people. You don't make the first point. That's not part of the science.
Yeah.
It's not part
of the stories out without the names.
You know, when they do a medical experiment, you don't know what the subjects are. You know, you don't need to. That's part of taking it out of law enforcement.
Yeah, Dave. Well, Rob, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. What's that? It's my music. Enjoy it.
Okay, great.